It's got groove. It's got meaning. It's the DVD Marquee. This week, your host, Jeff Rosato. That's me. And over there in the corner,
I'm Stan Williams, and I'm hopelessly devoted to you.
Unmistakable voices of Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta from the 1978 summertime feel-good musical classic Grease, which was issued on the 25th anniversary of its original release back in 2003, but now comes to us once more in a super deluxe single disc, but boy, is it a jam-packed single disc, Rocking Rydell Edition. Stan, I know you're familiar with the film, so what'd you think about the DVD?
Okay, one thing I want to say real quick.
Okay.
The whole Rockin' Rydell Edition.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Paramount, all you other companies who are coming out with these cutesy edition names, quit it, okay? The Ferris Bueller edition, the pretty in pink, what is it? Everything's ducky. Okay, it's not only bad, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing in that, you know, like when your mom or dad is trying to be hip or funny and it doesn't work and you squirm a little bit.
Uh-huh.
It's having that effect, so okay, knock it off. Okay, I feel better now.
Okay.
Anyway.
We're not responsible for the comments now. I agree with you. I guess they could have called it Extended Edition or Special Edition or whatever.
The Double Dip Edition. But anyway, I don't know. I'm kidding. You know, I remember Grease was re-released in theaters, I think, 1998, I guess
that
it was.
That sounds about right. Yeah, the 20th anniversary, I think it was.
Yeah, for like the 20th anniversary. And I remember being really excited about it.
Right.
Because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And, you know, I saw it a lot as a kid. I had fond memories of it. And I was looking forward to seeing it in a new light, seeing it on the big screen. And I remember being shocked at how bad a film I thought it was.
Really?
But that doesn't matter. But I mean, don't get me wrong, ultimately I don't think that matters. The great thing about this movie, it's the music and the star power, and that's there in droves. It's a fun movie, and this is definitely a good disc.
It had been a long time since I'd had an opportunity to watch this movie, and I kind of shied away from the first disc because I heard so many bad things about it from the transfer and so on. But going back and watching this again for the first time in probably 14 years was how vivid the memories came back into my head. I mean, it's like, okay, everybody that I knew in high school that I ran around with had this soundtrack in front of their bedroom stereo.
Hearing,
I mean, if you didn't have that, it was Saturday Night Fever, Boston, Frampton Comes Alive.
Exactly.
I mean, that whole period
exactly.
just came back.
And hearing a lot of these songs again, I was 9 years old again. I mean, it was kind of freaky.
You couldn't go anywhere, you know, in your car, you know, riding along with your mom and dad or, you know, driving yourself, and these songs just came on and you couldn't help but crank them up on the radio. And even now, you know, I'm in my 40s now, if it's one of those rare occasions when I listen to the radio, you know, most times I'm listening to, you know, podcast and stuff on my iPod in my car, but, you know, if I forget it or whatever and I've got the oldie station on and You're the One That I Want comes on, I'm going to take a ride around the block.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much fun.
I remember watching this movie again, you know, a few years ago, and being surprised by how, and maybe this isn't the right word for it, how dirty it still seems in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There's a weird quality, because I remember when we would drive around and listening to the 8-track in the car, me and my mom riding around listening to the 8-track, and how she would always skip over Grease Lightning, and I wasn't quite sure why. but I don't know. I think they even mention, I don't know if it was Alan Carr or one of the producers or somebody, even mentions when they were looking at it again, they were kind of surprised by some of the content they got away with.
Well, Randall Kleiser mentions in the commentary at one point that, you know, a lot of kids and young kids, you know, around 5-6 years old and up, really get into this movie. They enjoy it. And a lot of that stuff kind of flies over their head. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, the censorship board or the MPAA or whatever you call it, you know, maybe, you know, just flew by their heads too. But yeah, it is kind of, you know, sly and risque.
I think what it is, I guess maybe is because it does kind of have that kind of 50s high school, almost Happy Days kind of quality to it, which you're used to seeing in more of a, you know, more of a sanitized manner. But anyway, I think earlier, I think I actually referred to Grease as a film. I think that actually sounds kind of pretentious. Grease is a movie, and as a movie, it's a great movie.
It's like John Travolta said in one of the extras, you know, it's kind of entered the pop culture pantheon.
Yeah. And actually watching this disc and watching a lot of the bonus features, there's kind of a, and it's kind of appropriate considering where the film is set, there's kind of a high school reunion quality to it that I found very appropriate. It's nice to hear, you know, a few memories, you know, here and there. And that's what you get here. And it's nicely done.
And much better than the single disc edition, which I cannot comment on as far as picture or sound quality because I didn't buy it because I heard a lot of complaints about it. But watching this, I have no complaints whatsoever about the transfer. I hear some nitpickings like, well, if it doesn't have the original Paramount logo, I'm not going to buy it. You know, come on. I mean, it's just like being a little too picky. You know, I can admire people who are purists. I consider myself one in a way, but I don't want to get carried away with it. If it's the little stars converging around the Paramount mountain, beginning, you know, instead of a dirty Gulf Western Company, you know, that logo, you know, I don't care, you know, I mean, just if it looks good and sounds great, what's wrong with that?
I do have one complaint about this disc, and that simply is, George Lucas, damn it, why can't you give us an anamorphic original Star Wars trilogy?
Stan, it's a wrong movie.
I know, I just like taking any chance I have to do that.
You just now, you know, you hurt poor Randall Kleiser's, you hurt Randall Kleiser, is that correct? Uh-huh. I think you probably hurt Randall Kleiser a little bit. He used to be George Lucas's roommate.
Really?
I kid you not.
I did not know that.
IMDb is incorrect, you know, our apologies, but just you know, be careful. You never know who's going to be listening, you know.
Speaking of Randall Kleiser, did you make it through the commentary?
I did. For me, it was a nice, relaxed gathering of two people, and of course we're talking about the commentary with director Randall Kleiser and choreographer Patricia Birch. I thought it was okay. I mean, you know, nothing really earth-shattering, but just it was a nice little reunion of two friends.
Yeah, again, what do you expect?
I mean, you know, with
Grease.
Exactly. It starts out slow. There's a lot of pauses during the theme song, but it turns out to be a nice, charming conversation. Not a lot of deep insight. You got two close friends reminiscing.
Exactly.
Every once in a while, you get a good story or two, and that's all I ask out of a commentary track. Just, you know, keep me interested, make me laugh every once in a while, and feel like I've been invited to sit in and share in the memory-a-thon.
They throw in a lot of footage from the DVD release party.
That's right, yeah.
It was kind of neat, you know. It's almost like B-roll footage. It's not elaborately produced or anything, but you get to see Olivia singing Hopelessly Devoted again, and then the both of them doing You're the One That I Want, and the whole cast coming up to do Summer Nights.
Right.
Yeah. And there's just kind of a, you know, laid-back karaoke kind of feel to it that I kind of enjoyed in a goofy kind of way.
And it was like a home movie. I don't think it was intended for release, but some of that stuff was shown on entertainment shows like, you know, E.T. and Access Hollywood. And, you know, even though it was shot with just one camera, it was kind of like a home movie kind of thing. I enjoyed that aspect of it. It's got great sound quality.
If you're a fan of the movie, you know, that sort of thing is nice to see. I was kind of fascinated. They talk about, and they show a few clips from a television special for the premiere of the movie. And we see a few clips from that and like a couple of interviews, and even Rip Frickin' Taylor, and I gotta recommend any DVD that has Rip Frickin' Taylor,
of course,
in the bonus features. I did wish they would have just, you know, included the whole special. I don't know if there were rights issues or if they thought it was boring, or I don't. That would have been pretty interesting to see.
Well, you know, it's 2006, 2008 coming up. Yeah, there'll be a 30th anniversary edition down the pike. I can just see it now. But that crossed my mind as well. I would have liked to have seen the whole special. I mean, you know, more Olivia with that bouffant 70s hairdo. I mean, just, oh, those tight pants. Oh, good Lord. Anyway, but there's more great features on the DVD. Oh, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to go into the other features. There are some deleted scenes, mainly black and white stuff. I think they just kind of stumbled across in the vault. Nothing major. Nice to have.
Yeah.
Not a big deal. There's a segment on the Cars featuring George Barris.
created the infamous Batmobile.
Yeah, just about most of the famous TV cars you can think of from the 60s and other things.
In the end, would you recommend it for people that went out and bought the original?
I would. If you're a fan of the movie, it looks and sounds great. Again, maybe these don't add up to like incredibly substantial supplements. But again, and I'm not being insulting to the movie when I say it, it's Grease. And for what it is, I think it was nicely done.
Now, I don't want to leave without commenting on the picture quality. Once again, to me, this looks like the print that was used in the 98 version, judging by the modern-day Paramount logo coming up at the beginning. It looks terrific. It sounds great in 5.1. The music is the main part of this, and you want the music to sound good, and it mm-hmm. sounds really crystal clear. I don't have any complaints at all. As a matter of fact, I do believe this is the first time I've ever seen this movie in widescreen, and it's meant to be seen in widescreen.
Oh, definitely.
Because when I saw it on Showtime, HBO, and all that back in the day, there was a lot of grain, and I always wondered, oh, God, did they make it on the cheap or whatever? But it's just that increased resolution when you get those films, too tight, when you try to squeeze in so much. Here, it's just as clear as a bell for the most part, so it gets a high recommendation for me. It's one of the most fun movies ever made. So in the year of 2006, Grease is still the word, not only musically, but on DVD as well, from Paramount. Nice job, guys.
You want to knock him off, don't you?
That's a horrible thing to say.
What do you think I was, anyway? The guy that walks into a good-looking dame's front parlor and says, good afternoon, I sell accident insurance on husbands? You got one that's been around too long, one you'd like to turn into a little hard cash? Just give me a smile and I'll help you collect? Boy, what a dope you must think I am.
I think you're rotten.
I think you're swell, so long as I'm not your husband.
Get out of here.
You bet I'll get out of here, baby. I get out of here, but quick.
Stan, without meaning to, I think that you and I have created a unintentional Billy Wilder Film of the Month Club here on the DVD marquee, at least on our end. Last month, we took a look at Some Like It Hot from 1959, and this go-round, we're going to go all the way back to 1944 for the film noir classic Double Indemnity, the granddaddy of all film noirs, with Fred Murray, Barbara Stanwyck, and Edward G. Robinson. This is the film that involves a really sly, sarcastic, witty insurance guy by the name of Walter Neff going to check out a claim, and he runs into this drop-dead blonde bombshell named Phyllis, who's played by the wonderful Mrs. Stanwyck. And Walter gets a little bit more than he bargained for by falling in love with a woman, discovering she's in an unhappy marriage, and they kind of decide to, surprise, bump off her husband, and everything seems to go according to plan, and it's like a house of cards coming down.
And, we've all been in that situation, haven't we?
No, but I'd like to. You and I talked off the air, and I wasn't initially impressed with it, but after going back and concentrating solely on the film instead of trying to pay my bills and look at it at the same time, it wasn't a complete knockout, but I thought it was a really entertaining film. I can see where it has its place in cinema history.
Sometimes the buildup for something is so big that a movie is never going to live up to that.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that wasn't the case with me. I loved it. From the opening shot, I was hooked. I loved, loved, loved this movie.
Really?
Yeah. Oh my God, where to start? The way it's shot, the dialogue. This film has been talked about for 60 years, and for good reason. But we're talking about a movie here, and they kind of go into this on the disc. Film noir didn't exist before this movie. I mean, this movie...
There were maybe two or three films that kind of flirted with it, the same kind of lighting techniques and all that.
Yeah, but for all intents and purposes, this movie created that style. And, sometimes it's hard, something has been copied so many times that you forget that. I wasn't thinking that the whole time. I love the dialogue. I love the back and forth. And I'm just a sucker for that. And I'm a sucker for dark rooms and Venetian blinds and shadows and that dust in the air. And again, that dialogue and doomed guys with hats, and my God, that scene where right after the murder and he's walking away, and in his narration he says he realized he couldn't hear the sound of his own footsteps.
That's a great line.
That blew me away, because that's perhaps the best example of just
trouble in paradise. I mean, it seems like, everything seems so cool, and they look like they're gonna get away with it, and it starts to catch up with them, not just him but her. But I agree with you completely. in those areas. I found some of the dialogue to be just a little trite here and there, not too much, but you know, but one thing that really made me laugh, and it's an unintentionally funny moment, you know, he's going out, he's trying to forget about her, and then all of a sudden he winds up at a bowling alley, you know, like that, and it's just
that was strange. That was strange. It was like all of a sudden we go from Double Indemnity to The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, that's pretty apt. Yeah.
Yeah, gotta say, I didn't see that coming.
You know, I was expecting, you know, he'd be going down these streets with, you know, the neon signs and his shadow on the sidewalk and all that, but a bowling alley? I mean, just, it's still, you know, every time I see that, I'm going to laugh. I hate that, but just, that's about the only unfortunate bit of the film for me.
Like I said, I was just crazy about it. I didn't, and I hate to admit this, I think going into it, I had forgotten, actually, that it was directed by Billy Wilder, and I certainly didn't realize that Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler collaborated on the script.
That was a surprise, yeah. That's pretty cool.
And they have one of the documentaries on there. They kind of go in there, then some of the film historians here kind of cover the relationship between Wilder and Chandler, which sounds like they had a little bit of tension there.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Contrast in styles, yeah.
He said, you know, if we've unintentionally started the Billy Wilder Movie of the Month Club, hey, I'm all for that. Consider me converted, because to do this movie and to also direct one of the greatest comedies of all time, I mean, right. that just blows me away.
A lot of great versatility. Let's talk about the performances a little bit. I thought Fred Murray was pretty good. You know, I guess I'm so used to his persona on My Three Sons, and so it was kind of odd seeing him being in this kind of role.
But I think that's exactly what makes it work. Here's somebody you wouldn't expect in that position. And I think he was awesome. You know, there you see range there. You don't think of the guy from My Three Sons as having, you know, sex appeal. I like, personally, that people have that view of Fred McMurray and then see this movie, because I think it just adds to it.
I did find his performance better the second go-round, I'll put it that way. But as far as Barbara Stanwyck, my God.
And no offense to her, certainly, but I was like, I would see her and I'm like, this is the woman that would make him murder somebody? But they kind of go into it in the special features about the wig and everything, right, and how she was actually supposed to look, you know, a little trashy, a little, and then I'm like, okay, I guess I see that now.
Because, you know, if you've seen pictures of her with her natural hair at the time, which was red, you know, she was just not conventionally good looking, but just really attractive in an offbeat way, you know. And as far as acting ability, in 1941 alone, I was doing some research on her. In 1941 alone, she was in three films that were nominated for the Screenplay Award. In order, you know, I think in order to get those votes, you got to have people that are able to sell the story. Mm-hmm. And she does a great job. I thought Barbara Stanwyck was just simply fantastic in this role, but the unsung hero of this movie got to be Eddie G. Robinson. Was he not great?
Absolutely. He was hysterical, and I was completely not expecting that.
And he winds up being like the comic relief of this movie without really meaning to, and it's not really a comic relief role.
It could have very well been a thankless role. You know, it's very, I mean, he's there to be the straight, well, it's not a comedy, I don't know if you're saying he's a straight man, but he's, you know, the audience. He's the guy, well, I don't even know if he's that. I don't know.
Maybe the voice of reason.
Yeah, exactly. He is responsible for a lot of the ultimate tension in the movie. But there was something about him, it's like he somehow made this guy seem like a real guy. And he's funny without trying to be funny.
That's right. Very important.
What kind of an outfit is this anyway? Are we an insurance company or just a bunch of dim-witted amateurs to write a policy on a mug like that?
Now, wait a minute, Keys. I don't rate this beef. I clipped a note of that Gorlopa's application to have him thoroughly investigated before we accepted the risk.
I know you did, Walter. I'm not beefing at you. It's the company. It's the way they do things. The way they don't do things. The way they'll write anything just to get it down on the sales sheet. And I'm the guy that has to sit here up to my neck and phony claims that they won't throw more money out the window than they take in at the door.
Okay, turn the record over. Let's hear the other side.
Well, I get darn sick of trying to pick up after a gang of fast-talking salesmen dumb enough to sell life insurance to a guy who sleeps in the same bed with four rattlesnakes.
I'll tell you, this is a big sin as far as the Academy Awards. This film was nominated for 7 Oscars. He wasn't nominated for one of them. And I think that's a damn shame.
Well, I don't know. I gave up on the Academy Awards a long time ago, so I guess maybe they've been doing that sort of thing for years. But anyway, let's talk about the extras on this thing. You get 2 different commentaries. You get one commentary with film critic Richard Schickel, and another one with film historian and screenwriter Lim Dobbs, who worked on Dark City and a few other what are considered contemporary film noir, and film historian Nick Redman. Both of these commentaries are similar because you're getting guys who are kind of talking about it in kind of a sort of a scholarly historical historian kind of way. And honestly, that's the best thing with most of the, you know, most of the principles involved with the movie gone. That's the best thing you're going to get now. You know, in my film classes in college, we, you know, we talked about this movie, you know, all the time. And I'm a sucker for this sort of thing. I enjoyed both of them. It's really a shame if you think about it, that we never had DVD in the 1930s. Imagine what it would be like to have a disc where, you know, you do have Billy Wilder doing the commentary.
Right.
Or you have Fred McMurray, you know, on the commentary with him. But again, you know, this is as good as it's going to get. But let's get to the best actor extra, okay?
Okay.
In 1973, they remade this for television with Richard Crenna and...
Samantha Edgar.
Yeah, I could barely make it past the opening credits. Take it away, Jeff.
Matter of fact, Stan, let's let Richard Crenna and Fred McMurray take it away. I want to play you folks a comparison of, you know, the opening scene of the original and the remake, and just... we're going to let you guys formulate your own opinion. First of all, the original, 1944, with Fred McMurray.
When it came to picking the killer, you picked the wrong guy. You want to know who killed Dietrichson? Hold tight to that cheap cigar of yours, Keyes. I killed Dietrichson. Me, Walter Neff. Insurance salesman. 35 years old, unmarried, no visible scars. Until a while ago, that is. Yes, I killed him. I killed him for money. And for a woman. And I didn't get the money, and I didn't get the woman.
And now, the 73 remake. In color.
In her office memo. Walter Neff, DeBarton Keyes, claims manager. I'm speaking to you, Keyes. And nobody else, you big, clumsy chimpanzee. You want to know who killed him? Hmm? Hang on to that wet cigar butt, Keyes. I did. It was me. Walter Neff, age 36, unmarried, no visible scars. Until an hour ago, that is. Simple fact is, I killed a man. I killed him for money and a woman. Only I didn't get the money. I don't want the woman.
Man, I gotta tell you, I loved Richard Crenna when I was a kid. I grew up with Real McCoy reruns, and he was in a lot of great TV movies, but this wasn't one of them. It was like an off Broadway play that only got as far as Bayonne, New Jersey.
I wouldn't be that kind to it. This is the textbook definition of god awful. But it's a great, great, great extra, because
it's like the Snakes on a Plane version of Double Indemnity.
If you want to learn about directing, watch the original version of Double Indemnity. And right. Then watch the TV remake, because the TV remake takes everything that was in the original and botches it up.
And as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, on one of the commentaries, or no, it was the best extra on the disc for me, and we forgot to talk about this, was the documentary, but we'll go there in just a second. But mm-hmm. Just, they didn't deviate hardly at all from the original.
It's a hopeless task remaking, because... I think you can't take this movie out of the 30s.
No.
You know, because that sort of dialogue is not going to work in the 1970s.
Exactly.
And the lighting and all of that, all of a sudden, you know, translating this, all of a sudden it's this bright California sunshiny lighting everywhere with all the lights turned on in the house. And
I mean, it looked like it was shot on the set of Mannix or Cannon, you know? I mean, you know... the cheesy detective shows back in the 70s we knew and loved, but just, you know, and you know, God bless them, you know, they did the best they could, you know, got some good people.
It's
Lee J. Cobb, Robert Weber, who played Maddie's dad on Moonlighting.
It's basically Billy Wilder by way of Mannix.
Exactly, and, you know, I got off on a tangent there, but what I was going to say about the documentary, there's a bit in there where Billy Wilder apparently called Barbara Stanwyck at home and said, "They blew it," and hung up the phone. So I think that's enough said about the 73 remake, but yeah. My favorite extra on the disc is the 37-minute making of, which was just one of the best documentaries on the film I have ever seen. It hits all the right notes. It's not too short. It's not too long. Perfect length. Everything that you wanted to know about the making of, from, you know, Barbara Stanwyck's, you know, indecision about taking the part, the blonde wig, which we talked about, Edward G. Robinson's contribution to the film, its place in history. Oh, it's so good. It's one of the best extras I've seen on a Universal disc in a long, long time. So hats off to the people that produced this.
It really is a good documentary. The only criticism I would have is, and really it's the best criticism you can have, is I wish it were even longer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ultimately I don't know what else they could have done. You know, they talked to James Ellroy in there, you know, who's written, you know, author of L.A. Confidential, a lot of, you know, sort of modern film noir. Yeah, they cover the relationship between Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler. It's a nice, quick way to learn a lot about the movie, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting. There were parts of the movie I was wondering, did they mess up the transfer? That's dark. I mean, that is dark. And did they mess up the transfer? And,
exactly.
You know, but no. I mean, you know, they talk about this. The movie was just shot that way. And I knew this was going to be a dark movie going into it, but, you know, sometimes it's almost pitch black when somebody is talking.
If you looked at the trailer, it looks like they doctored up the trailer to make it look more audience friendly, because, you know, just some of the lighting, and I don't know if it was a re-release trailer or an original trailer, but just it's like, man, this is completely different. And if it's representative of what they put out on DVD a few years ago, yeah, I can see why people may have been a little tipped off. But to me, it's about as good as it's ever going to look.
Bottom line for me, it's a great disc. I think it deserves a place on everybody's shelf.
Regardless of how many times Fred McMurray says, baby.
Look, baby, you can't get away with it. You bet I'll get out of here, baby. I'm crazy about you, baby. And I don't want you to hang, baby. They're not going to hang you, baby. We're hitting it for the limit, baby. I better go, baby. Okay, baby, that's it.
In the land of Mordor, in the fires of Mount Doom, the Dark Lord Sauron forged in secret a master ring to control all others. And into this ring, he poured his cruelty, his malice, and his will to dominate all life. One ring to rule them all.
Okay, next up is the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which I won't even bother trying to do an introduction for. Basically, New Line has re-released these now with on disc, with all the discs, including both the original theatrical version and the extended director's cuts that I'm sure pretty much all of us have already bought. And really, the main reason for these discs to exist is each disc now features a new, pretty much feature-length documentary on the making of each movie.
You know, and it must be Christmas season in the air already, because I can't think of any other reason why they would sell these again. And while I did like the documentaries, you know, they're a real nice fly-on-the-wall experience, the biggest disappointment that I have, and apparently a lot of other people have had, is that when they want to watch the theatrical edition, and by the way, going into this, I had not seen The Two Towers or Return of the King.
Yet you have time for Desperate Housewives.
Well, it's priorities, Stan. You know, Marshall Cross, you know, join the club. Sorry. You know, I had not seen the final two films in this series, and I went and watched the theatrical cuts, and I was so excited because, you know, it seemed like, you know, you had the promise of both the theatrical and the expanded edition, but I chose the theatrical for, you know, my first viewing of Two Towers and Return of the King. Now, I'm a guy, you know, it's quirky, I know, but just I like to be settled in on my couch with my popcorn, my cola, trying to recreate the theatrical experience at home, the one that I missed in the theater, and all of a sudden, I'm into things, and it's like I gotta flip it over. What have we gone back in time, 10 years or whatever? I was really, really disappointed.
It's a strange choice. It's a strange choice to bring them out that way. But I don't know. That's neither here nor there for me, really. I mean, I think the main reason for these discs existing is the documentaries.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the deal is. I don't know. It seems like I read somewhere that maybe there was a legal issue why the documentaries couldn't be released by themselves. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Huh.
But anyway, for me, it just simply boils down to this. I mean, I'm still going through the extras on the original disc. They did such an outstanding job of those.
Yeah.
And I think it boils down to how big of a Lord of the Rings fan you are. The documentaries are fine. Like you said, they're kind of a fly on the wall thing, you know. It's like home footage of, you know, the actors goofing off and everything, and that's always charming. Unfortunately, you know, the episode one disc, they did the documentary in a similar style, The Beginning, which I think ultimately was a much better documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. If you're a big Lord of the Rings fan, I guess go for it. Lost is the kind of TV series that DVD is just made for. Watching this on DVD is probably the perfect way to watch this show. However, you know, if you're like us who've watched Lost on a weekly basis on network TV, you want to recreate the network experience, do this. Get your Lost DVD and watch the first two episodes, okay? Wait 2 weeks, then watch a recap of those two episodes, okay? Go another week, watch one of those two episodes again. Wait 3 weeks, watch a new episode, watch a recap episode, and then repeat.
Yeah, they have had some problems in terms of continuity and audience anticipation, but you know, you don't have those issues here. I mean, all is forgiven on the DVD release of Lost Season 2, The Extended Experience, and this is just another great set that follows in the footsteps of the Season 1 package. Great extras, superb picture quality, and you've got all of these stories back-to-back, all 24 of them, and I've had a blast reliving every moment from where they went into the hatch for the first time until the thing exploded in a mind-bending two-hour finale.
I really like this show, too. It's in a weird way, it's kind of fun to sit back and watch this show just kind of as a phenomenon, because you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. You're waiting for the creators to just drop the ball, right, in a way. And I think, I don't know, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, I'm like everybody else. I want to know what's going on. You know, I have my theories. You know, it walks that very fine line that, you know, Twin Peaks, The X-Files walked. It's like you want to keep people in suspense, but you also kind of have to start giving, you know, give them answers every now and then. And that's, you know, that's a hard act to pull.
It's a difficult balancing act.
Yeah, and I think what we tend to forget is ultimately Lost isn't a show about that. It's a very character-driven show, and each episode lives or dies by the flashback, basically.
And most of them are just superb, in my opinion. I don't think they drop the ball hardly at all. There may be some episodes that aren't as, say, emotionally driven or get you right in the gut or the heart. But when it's good, it's good. And a great example of that, Stan, is the 23rd Psalm, Mr. Echo's flashback, which may have been the finest hour of TV I experienced last year.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the shadow of the valley of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod, thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
It's a great episode. I believe it's definitely the best episode from either of the two seasons so far.
So let's compare season one versus season two. Better, worse, about the same?
I'd probably give the edge to season one because it was newer then. You know, we weren't really expecting it. And now, like I said, there is that kind of, well, you know, we want answers now. We want, you know, where is this heading? You know, I don't sit around and come up with like the complicated theories. There are things every now and then I wonder, it's like, okay, seems like when this series started, there were like polar bears and weird things running around and they were very afraid to go out into the woods.
Uh-huh.
And then it seems like the next week they're running around the woods barefoot, not even thinking about it. And it seems a little inconsistent to me.
Yeah, I noticed that. There's an episode called What Kate Did, which aired in late November, if I remember correctly. And there's a horse, you know, very symbolic. And all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, now we're back into the animals thing again, you know. And then a little bit later on, we had the mysterious black smoke, you know, that Locke was almost done in by during the first season. I mean,
I like being
But the performances are just great.
Yeah, I like being at this point. I like still not knowing. You know, we're still at that point where we don't know. I think the show is kind of in danger of losing people in the third season. I'm really, really, really curious where they go.
Let's talk about some of the extras. Disc 7, I mean, I spent like maybe 6 hours with this thing and never got bored once. I mean, it's just incredible. The creators of these DVDs or the Lost packages, they know their fan base. They know what people want, and they do it in such an entertaining, jazzy way. I just loved it.
You said you spent 6 or 7 hours on it. I would recommend this based solely on they do a documentary, and it's only about half an hour long. They do a documentary covering the production of one single episode.
Fire plus water.
And I think it's hands down the best documentary in terms of a television show. It's hands down the best documentary in terms of the making of a television show that I've seen, because
they
cover the entire process from the writers sitting down to getting the idea to location scouting, to the props, even down to them delivering the film at the end of shooting, and the guy who delivers the film. They cover everything, and it's great.
I was excited, you know, it's silly, but I was excited seeing that plane carrying this film, you know, to this guy and him delivering the, you know, LAX, you know, it was just something about it. And then you go into the rooms where they're doing post-production and sound cleanups, you know, and so on. And it was just so fascinating, and not done in a technical aspect where it turns you off, but just down to earth, you know, talking. And I just loved it. It was great.
I think a lot of times there's a process for those of us who love movies and studying movies and learning about the movies we love. There's a process, I think, gets skipped a lot of the times when people are talking about it. Sure, you get to hear the director, you know, saying, well, I was thinking this. You get to have the actors maybe talk about a little bit about their characters, but you never get to see the thousands of other people involved in the process.
And it's more than, you know, this ensemble. There's a lot of people behind the scenes that are very vital to the creation of the show, from the makeup people, the people, you know, in post-production and all that. And I just loved every bit of it. There's a part where the actor playing Henry Gale looks so different in makeup, and it's like there's something they're doing to this guy. And I don't want to give it away, because I don't want to give away every secret of this documentary, but the simple effect of how, you know, they get part of his face to look different, it's just, you know, let's not give it away, but just, oh man, it's something as simple as that. No wonder he looks different in street clothes and all
just
that.
Just the menu, the way the disc is set up with the guys in the lab coats from the Hanzo Foundation, the Dharma Initiative, and you're exactly right. They know exactly what the fans of this show want, and they deliver it in spades.
It's divided into three phases, and there's so many highlights that we just don't have time to go into them all. And I want those of you that are excited about this, as I am, to experience the joy of discovering all these special moments. I will say one, they kind of take a break from filming to watch the whales come out of the water. That was just simply fantastic. You know, and she goes, we're whale watching, and just taking a break from, you know, doing all this stuff, and just, my God, what a great locale that must be to shoot a television series.
Yeah, and I mean, there are a lot of sound bites with the actors. You know, you still get your kind of, you know, EPK stuff in there, sound bites in there, but that's not all that's there. There's a documentary on just the making of the hatch.
Right.
Just from their conception, the writers talking about the idea of the hatch to everything in the thought process, from coming up with it to actually making it an actual set and then touring the set. And it's just, if you love the show, or if you're interested in the show, you're going to love watching this disc.
And there are several episodes that have several mini making ofs that were great. And one that I found really fascinating was the episode focusing on one of Charlie's flashbacks, where, you know, he's writing the song with his brother, and the band Driveshaft is doing some kind of promotional thing, and they're in this gigantic baby crib with these severed arms and stuff like that.
Again, and we've all been there.
And yeah, but what blew my mind, and this was really, really cool, you know, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and to hear that they were kind of inspired to do that from the infamous Yesterday and Today album cover that featured the Beatles with severed dolls, arms, legs, heads, and raw meat, which Capitol rejected, no surprise. They based that concept for Drive Shaft's promotional thingy on that same album cover. I mean, just I love hearing stuff like that. Now, if you like the way Season 1 looked, same song, different verse, but the same wonderful quality. It doesn't have that TV on DVD feel look, where you have a lot of video noise, compression artifacts, and so on. You can see pores, the whites in people's eyes, the texture of the bad hair pieces and the flashbacks. I mean, you know, it's just incredible.
It looks so good. I wish I had the patience, you know, to just wait until it did come out on DVD, which I don't have, because I'm stunned at how much better this always looks than, you know, I've got a satellite dish. It looks fine, but on DVD, it just blows it away.
It's so close to HD that it's just incredible. I'm not sure who masters this TV show, but they ought to be given some kind of an award, because it looks fabulous, it sounds great, and for those of you with incredible willpower, we envy you, because you are going to get not just the experience that we had over 8 to 10 months, you know, waiting for episodes, surviving reruns of retrospective episodes that were run like 70,000 times. You all know what I'm talking about, the true fans out there. But Lost Season 2, the extended experience, is my champion so far for the best TV set on DVD of 2006 thus far. Stan, again, thank you so much. Pleasure to have you around.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure. Hey, can I plug my website?
Sure.
Quick plug here. If you want to visit my MySpace page, it's myspace.com/TheRealStanWilliams. There's another one out there. I don't know if killing him will make me more powerful in the Highlander kind of way. But anyway, a couple of my short films up there. If you're interested, go by, give it a look.
And finally, obligatory plug for Podcast Alley. It's a new month, the start of every month. The slate is wiped clean, and we'd like for you to vote on the show if you enjoy it as much as we enjoy making it. It's a very simple process. All you got to do is go to www.thedvdmarquee.com, scroll down the page, and if you look to your immediate right, you'll see, you know, vote for us, that little icon. Put your email address in there. You'll get a confirmation email in return. Answer that baby back, and you've made us proud.
And now let's check in with Shane, who's got a preview of our next show.
Hi, this is Shane from the Canadian Connection of the DVD Marquee. On our next episode, we have some great titles coming up. We're going to look at four titles, all coming from Fox Home Entertainment: The Rocky Horror Picture Show, 30th Anniversary Edition, Taps, the second movie ever for Tom Cruise, X-Men The Last Stand, and Thank You for Smoking. So tune in next time here on the DVD Marquee.
For the DVD Marquee, I'm Jeff Rosato.
And I'm Stan Williams.
Keep listening. We'll see you next time.
And we're clear.
All right.
Excellent.
You know, I know it's kind of quirky, but I'm the kind of guy that likes to, you know, get into position on... Damn, the age of innocence is gone. Okay, three, pole position. Okay, three, two, and we all know how painful that can be. 3, 2, 1.